Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, who organized tonight's event. Tonight, we'll be speaking as part of the Monday Night Philosophy series about the 500th anniversary of the book Utopia by Thomas More. Now, I know that most of you are saying 500 years already. It just seems like yesterday, you know. But it was in 1516 in Antwerp when Thomas More was a young diplomat, relatively young, in his mid-30s for King Henry VIII. And he was a friend of Erasmus. Some of you know that, maybe don't know that. By this time, he'd already known him for 15, 16 years because Erasmus had come in 1499 to England. Those of you who remember that visit. And they had met and talked about a lot of things. And obviously, they were similar characters, which I'll talk about in a little while. So Erasmus being in the area, More was a diplomat in Bruges on a negotiation for some merchant. It was a goods transfer that was taking place. It wasn't a military or political issue. And all the French negotiators decided to go back to Paris to get more instructions from their boss. And so More had like 2 months on his own. He went off to Antwerp. He couldn't go back to England because he didn't know when they were going to come back. And he met with his friends. And they started talking about things. And he came up with this idea for the book Utopia and wrote the bulk of it, book two. And then several months later, he wrote the first part of it. And then his friend Erasmus published it at the end of 1516. So that's a little bit about the book. I want to talk about these characters because, Thomas More has come down to us in an image. Like a lot of things over time, we have images that stand in for us and give us the information about a certain character or whatever, and it just so happens. Well, it doesn't just so happen because it was intentional. But there's a Hans Holbein portrait of Thomas More, Hans Holbein being a very famous painter in Holland. And how he came to do that was that Thomas More's friends in Holland and on the continent said, hey, there's this really cool young painter. You know, have him come up to your house, do your paintings, and show him around town and get him to do paintings of the famous people, et cetera, et cetera. Give him some work. So it's always kind of interesting to hear about somebody as famous as Hans Holbein and say, how did he get his start? What happened? He got passed around by people who recognized his talent, as is often the case. And that's why Thomas More's painting was done by him and is still famous. And of course, his whole family, a painting or a sketch for a painting was done. And other, King Henry VIII eventually got it and so on and so forth. So we see Hans Holbein when he's young. And I want you to see Thomas More when he's young because that picture of him is when he's a little bit older. He's Lord Chancellor of England. And it's a striking picture because More is sitting there and he's got the robes of state on. He's got this gold chain. For those of you who want to see it in person, it's at the Frick Museum in New York. And he looks like a monk, an ascetic monk wearing all these fancy clothes, And he really stands out because it's very clear he doesn't look like the normal English courtier. He doesn't look, as I said, he looks like he could be a monk. And that's really a big part of his character. Not that he could be a monk, he was a family man, but he was an ascetic in many, many different ways. And I want to explain a little bit about him because I think he's not this severe character that picture sort of tends to show. He was under severe stress at that point in his life. And I remember, this is just a sideline, but my father was under severe stress when I was in high school. He was working for a bank, and he was the vice president, and the next year he was going to be the president of the bank, and he was in his mid-60s. And it was a small bank in Wisconsin. And a guy came in about 6 months before he was supposed to take over and bought the bank, and the guy was 27 years old. And he fired everybody over 35 years of age, except for my father, who was in his 60s. And so my father, for the next 4 or 5 years, was under severe stress, always thinking he was going to lose his job and everything. And he had 10 kids still at home out of the 12 that he had had. So he had to worry about it. And I have a picture of my father from that time. We were at an event where there was a crowd of people all cheering and laughing and stuff. And my father's sitting in that audience with everybody cheering and laughing all around him. He's sitting there like that. Was totally, you could tell he's thinking about something else, he's doing something else. And I use that as an example because this is what I think More was in his situation. He was Lord Chancellor, he knew his neck was on the line. He knew that whatever he did, all he could do was delay the inevitable. And it was very clear from his writing he knew that that was going to happen. So it's important, I think, to understand him in another context. You know, he was a pleasure principle man. He was after fun. He enjoyed everything that he could, and it's all in the Utopia books as well. That doesn't sound medieval at all when he talks about pleasure. And this is why Utopia was such an unusual description at the time, because he makes fun of all of the serious things that people do and says, you know, if a pleasure doesn't get in the way of inconvenience to anybody, it shouldn't be disallowed. It shouldn't be disallowed. So I think Moore as a personality is in a character category which is relatively small. It's Voltaire, Plato, Jonathan Swift, Mark Twain. These people have an interesting set of problems in their personalities. And those problems are very, very different than the usual. Usually, people talk about, you know, the fight between good and evil. And in philosophy, you know, the fight between this and the good and evil, and who are the good people, who are the bad people, and, you know, that kind of thing. But what's really interesting is when there's a conflict between two goods. There's two good things, and you have a conflict between them. You have to figure out which to choose. This happens in life all the time. In this case, these men that I just mentioned had a three-way conflict, a triangulation between three good things, which they really admired, but which they had difficulty making cohere together, because it is very difficult, in fact, probably impossible, to make them cohere together. And that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit tonight, and also how that results in humor, in irony, in satire. So I have a definition of satire. Satire is a sophisticated lie told in a humorous way to reveal a more painfully funny truth. Okay? And this is exactly what Utopia is. It is a very sophisticated lie, and it's used, and there's lots and lots of humor in it, but it's also used to push back on it. And I'll give you some examples. I won't do too much reading tonight because it gets a little boring if you just quote from the book. But I'm going to read a little bit of the different things to give you the flavor of how the medievalists, and Erasmus, very, very similar in his approach to things too, do this. Now, what was this three-way problem that Moore and Erasmus were both working on along with some other people on the continent? As I said, they met. I'll give you a little bit about biography about Thomas More to give you an idea. But he went to Oxford as a 14-year-old, which was not too young because that was the usual then. It's not like he was a genius or something like that. But he went at the usual time. His father was a lawyer and his grandfather was a lawyer, and they wanted him to become a lawyer, so they pulled him out after a couple of years. But he got a really good classical education and was, at the time, it was very popular to read Lucian, who was a satirist, whose works had been recovered. Those of you who are here to hear Stephen Greenblatt speak about The Swerve, the book The Swerve by him several years ago, that's exactly what influenced Thomas More and his group, was that book had been brought out maybe 50, 60 years earlier than that and recovered, and it was influencing the universities everywhere. So as young men, they were all reading this and laughing about it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the three-way problem that they have is that they have three different ideals. So one ideal is human civilization. And they look around and say, we can make this better than it is. There's so many things that go wrong and so on and so forth. And so they had a social political ideal that they wanted to achieve. They also believed in reason. They were very, very reasonable about how to go about things. And they were all in favor of the reasonable philosophers and so on and so forth. And they also believed in God and the idea of perfection and making things perfect. In fact, part of the political goal was, you know, trying to make human race perfect, or at least good enough that it didn't make God mad so much as before. But this, to try to do something that's very reasonable and always have that and always have, you know, the subservience to God and God's plan and what that perfection is, and to aim for that perfection. At the same time, you want to make human civilization better. Those three things create a great deal of tension, and you can see it in each of their writings. Voltaire, there is this emotional yearning, both either for God or for human civilization or for something ideal or something perfect, something better. So there's an emotional yearning. But there is this skepticism, which is based on reason, you know, because it doesn't make sense. Yeah, we can say that, but it doesn't make any sense. You know, like one of the jokes in Utopia that I figured the Commonwealth Club members would really like is that, you know, obviously Moore gave a lot of lectures and he enjoyed this very much, public lectures and everything. He says two funny jokes, which are not clearly jokes. One of the things that happens in Utopia is that before dawn every day, there's a public lecture that everybody comes and attends and listens to. Now, obviously, he stated that as a fact, as a delusional fact. Nobody would ever come before dawn to hear, like, no matter how much you like these lectures, how many of you would come if we had him before dawn? You know, so that's a sly aside, you know, one way. And another one was saying, you know, during dinner times, because they had meals in common, so there would usually be someone who would speak some good words, you know, from some of their literature or whatever, to, you know, enliven the atmosphere. And then his next line is, but they kept it very short to avoid boredom. So here's a man making jokes like this continuously throughout Utopia, and there's a lot of jokes that people don't see and haven't seen. I've tried to find, you know, like, did somebody write about this joke, or did somebody write about this joke that I've seen? And I don't find some, so I'll go into those a little bit later. But we have that tension. Now, that tension's enough. But if you even a three-way one, if you even only have a two-way one, if you look for satire and irony, it's often this combination of emotional yearning for something beautiful at the same time that your reason is telling you to be very skeptical about it. And the result of that conflict is irony and satire and humor. And sometimes, if you're really disappointed, it's very biting satire. And sometimes it's very congenial because you're... So the emotion that's involved in it has a lot to do with the personality. And most of Utopia is very, very congenial satire. And some of his later writings are very biting. His attacks on Luther are extremely, very, very even difficult to read through. And the reason for that I'll explain a little bit later. So this is the way it started. Now, a lot of people, when I mentioned this about Moore, that he was a pleasure principle guy. Oh, no way, no way. So I'm going to use a couple examples, but I'm going to read you one thing, not from Utopia, but from a book he wrote in 1522, when he was about, you know, 6 or 7 years older than he was when he wrote Utopia. And he wrote this things like this all through his life. Even when he was about to be killed by King Henry VIII, he wrote very similar things. And the other thing that I wanted to read this slightly lengthy paragraph for was part of the English, the use of the English, because I know a lot of you feel that Shakespeare, you know, is, you have to work at it to read Shakespeare because it's 400 years old now. Now, this is 500 years old, or almost 500 years old, and there's only one word that you probably don't know, and that sounds unusual, and that word is leafer, for those of you who don't know. It just means rather. It's just an old word for rather. So, and this is a good example, both of his English skills, which had a big influence on Shakespeare, but also how he thought about pleasure. Wonder, and also what he thought about the human race. Wonder it is that the world is so mad that we had liefer take sin with pain than virtue with pleasure. For, as I said in the beginning, and often shall say, virtue bringeth his pleasure, and vice is not without pain. And yet speak I not of the world to come, but of the life present. If virtue were all painful and vice all pleasant, yet since death shall shortly finish both the pain of the one and the pleasure of the other, great madness were it if we would not rather take a short pain for the winning of everlasting pleasure than a short pleasure for the winning of everlasting pain. But now, if it be true, as it is indeed, that our sin is painful and our virtue pleasant, how much is it then a more madness to take sinful pain in this world that shall win us eternal pain in hell, rather than pleasant virtue in this world that shall win us eternal pleasure in heaven? He makes a lot of arguments like that, and that's a very interesting sign of his tension with God, actually, because his observation, and when he does his analysis in Utopia, where they don't have the Catholic religion, they don't have Christian religion, you have something totally different. You know, Moore was more Protestant than the Protestants in the religion that he created in Utopia. And in that, they just use reason to show them why they should pursue the virtues. And he makes a lot of jokes about it, too, because he knows that even though reason indicates that that's a good idea, that people still won't do it. But it's his argument. So That yearning is a very important part of it, and the skepticism and the irony. The other element of Thomas More's life that is brought out by the Man for All Seasons and other things is his friendship. Erasmus was asked about, you know, a year after Utopia came out. Erasmus had arranged for Utopia to be published. Thomas More was fairly unknown at the time. Erasmus was already a famous scholar. And so a lot of people on the continent who are also scholars or leaders or princes and so on and so forth who knew about him wrote to Erasmus and said, who is this guy? A very interesting book. Who is this guy? By the way, just from a factual point of view, it was only published in Latin. It didn't really circulate in England where it would get him in trouble. It circulated on the continent where you know, among his friends. This German prince wrote to Erasmus and asked him to write about Thomas More and what he was like. And Erasmus has wrote maybe a 10 or 15 page letter, which is still around, that you can read it. But one of the things he focuses on about Thomas More's character is that he was born for friendship, that he could be friendly with everybody from the highest monarch in the land all the way to the lowest person, the servant that worked for you know, a servant. That he could get along with everybody and make everybody more cheerful and so on and so forth. So he was one of those kind of guys. And that's why it's ironic that this picture has come down to us of a very stern-faced person, because he was almost exactly the opposite person. And the other thing is that he was a very simple eater. He liked simple food. He liked simple dress. He didn't really pay attention whether, you know, his very fancy clothes. He wore his fancy clothes the way people often wear their bad clothes. I mean, he didn't pay attention. And that was very bad for a courtier. And, of course, got him in a lot of trouble as a courtier. But, you know, it was just considered that was, you know, one of his odd habits. And also, the other thing he mentioned even first was his wit. He said he had an angelic wit. Now, the word wit, of course, is a little bit old-fashioned at this point. But that humorous attitude towards making fun of lots of things and intelligent, humorous observations, that wit, that word wit, Erasmus said he had the most interesting wit in England that he'd ever heard about. You know, that was obviously prior to Shakespeare. So that's the kind of character that he was. Now, what was his story? His story was he was born, as I said, to a lawyer, a relatively successful, you know, ended up being a small judge, worked for the king on some things. And because of that, he was placed as a young boy, as was often done, in the household of an important person in order to learn to be a courtier. And he was placed in the house of Cardinal Morton, who eventually became Lord Chancellor himself. And Cardinal Morton noticed More right away, because they would have plays at Christmas time and so on. And he wasn't part of the plays, but even as a young boy, he would run up on the stage, and then he would make jokes and add words and so on and so forth very cleverly, and that was always the best part of whatever the play was, even though he wasn't supposed to be part of the play. So he was, again, that kind of a character, seen as a young boy and the cardinal said, you know, he's gonna be a very interesting man, watch out, you know, sort of thing. And so, in a way, it's kind of funny, because I mentioned Mark Twain before. A lot of the stories about him make Thomas More sound a little like Tom Sawyer, and in the way that he approached all kinds of things. So, again, something that one wouldn't think of because of the image that was given to him. So he went on to Oxford, as I said, and then his father took him out of Oxford, but there he had studied Greek and Latin, so on and forth. He brought him to London to become a lawyer. He went to Lincoln's Inn after a couple of other ones. He got into the one that his father had been in. While he was this young, late teenager and early 20s, he gave lectures on St. Augustine's City of God around places. He lived at the Charterhouse Monastery at the time. It became a school later on, but it was a monastery at the time, a Carthusian monastery. And they'd let non-monks live there, but he lived there as a student, sort of, but obviously because it made the rest of his life simple. But that came to an end when he went to visit someone that he worked with, an older man who he worked with in the law, who had three daughters. And so he decided to move out and he married one of the daughters, the oldest daughter. So he had a family, four or five kids. Unfortunately, his wife died in bearing the fourth child, or the fifth child, that didn't survive as well. And a month later, he married another woman. And everyone said, you know, just a month later, how could you do that? Well, he was very busy with the king, and the woman he married was a friend of the family who was a widow who also had another daughter that they knew, and everyone wonders what kind of a relationship they actually had. But this is the Dame Alice that's in, you know, the movies and so on. It was his second wife. She was a widow, and they were really good friends, but she wasn't well-educated to be his kind of wife. So, but they got along really well, and he teased her all the time, and she teased him back. So they had that kind of a relationship, and they carried on all the way to the end. But the stories that are told, of course, she was really, really disappointed in the decisions he made at the end of his life, because she rather enjoyed being the Lord Chancellor's wife. You know, and you know, what are you doing this for? So we'll go into that a little bit later. So he then, as I said, got these assignments from the king. The first thing he did before King Henry VIII got on the throne, he was a burgess in Parliament. He was elected to Parliament, and he had this first thing. And the king, King Henry VII, his oldest daughter was getting married, and he wanted a tax to pay for her wedding. That's how the kings did things. And so he asked for a tax of 3/15, you know, on all the property. It was a property tax on all the rich people. And Thomas More, being, you know, 23 or 24 years old, gave a speech in Parliament against it that was so convincing that everyone voted against it. And the king was very upset. Who was this? You know, his counselor sent back a thing. Some beardless boy just talked you out of your, you know, the money for your daughter's wedding. You know, and this is who it is, and get on him. And he couldn't get him directly, so he put his father, Thomas More's father, in prison on a trumped-up charge and fined him £100, which was a lot of money. And Thomas More thought he was going to have to leave town because it kept getting worse. A bishop pulled him in for a meeting, you know, and started talking to him and saying, you know, well, if you do this, the king might like you again, or if you do this, the king might like you again. So it was very clear that the king was really, really furious with him, and no matter what he did, he said that, you know, More went to one of his friends, being a good lawyer, and said, so does this bishop really keep his word when he makes these deals? No, he doesn't keep his word at all. They're just going to nail you. So he was packing up to leave, and King Henry VII died. And that was the end of that, because King Henry VIII was a young man and very interested in learning as a young man, and a prince who was a Renaissance kind of prince at the time. I mean, in the end, he proved more fatal to Thomas More than his father would have. But at the beginning, for the first 10, 15 years, they were really good friends. And Erasmus and Thomas More's friends on the continent were all excited that there was a prince who was interested in Renaissance things. Just shows you that no matter how much you're interested in ideas and wisdom and everything, if you need a son, you need a son, and you know everything else just falls by the wayside when you're king. So including all your friends and everybody else. So More just gradually, I mean, he resisted. You can see in Utopia, he talks all about should you work for a king or should you not work for a king. That's one of the big issues that he has, because he was trying to be pulled in to the service of the king. And so it was on his mind, and he was debating with himself in public in his book. And I think the year afterwards, he started doing more work for the king besides going on these embassies and stuff like that, and got pulled into the service of the king and made his way up until he was, worked for Cardinal Wolsey, who was the Lord Chancellor, and then replaced him later on as the Lord Chancellor for a few years before he lost his head. So More rose like that. His family did very well. He educated his daughters. His daughters were among the best educated women in Europe. Erasmus, as some of you know, was well known for his Greek translation, his going back to the original Greek of the New Testament and putting out a new translation based on that. He was helped in that by Thomas More's oldest daughter. She went through and read the Greek and read the things and caught typos and so on and so forth. So she was very, very, there's a cute little clip in the Man for All Seasons movie about this, where the king says something to her in Latin and she responds in Latin. He says something else. She responds with two sentences and he goes, ooh, you're already past my Latin skills. And it's just a little clip, but obviously it was not common to educate the women like that at the time. But More was a Platonist, and Plato, educated women as well. And, you know, so this was among the Platonists, this was what happened. And as I said, he kept up his sense of humor to the end. There was a relatively serious pressure, obviously, put on him at the end. Because the king, when he was in prison for not signing the decree allowing the king to divorce his wife and to become the head of the church and you know, marry Anne Boleyn and have a son if she could, et cetera, et cetera. Almost everybody said yes. I mean, as is usually the case when people are working for a king, whatever the king says, almost everybody says yes. So lots of bishops said yes, all kinds of religious people said yes, et cetera, et cetera. By the way, you know, although the Catholic Church made Thomas More a saint, you know, I don't think, you know, it took him almost 400 years. And the reason is because there's a lot of things in Utopia which would make them wonder how Catholic he really was. For example, he makes about 10 or 15 jokes about priests in the Utopia. And one of them, you know, there's some of them are very sly. Some of them are straightforward. Like one of the jokes in Utopia is that everybody only has to work 6 hours a day. And in the Utopia, how can you do that? Everybody has to work all the time. I mean, how could you possibly cut back to just 6 hours a day? And the guy explains, all those people that don't really do anything, are all now doing this simple work too. And he mentions priests, you know, I mean, priests don't do anything, the nobles don't do anything, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and the women should do more work. And if everybody shares in this, we can all do this and have a good time. And then he makes another joke. He says, what do people do with this, all this extra time? They use it to cultivate their minds, which he means seriously, but he also knows that would never happen. You know, that's not what people would do if they had all that free time. So, and one of the other jokes, one of the slyer jokes about priests is that the Utopians have very few priests at all, you know, just 10 or 13 per city, and the cities are pretty big. And the reason is because you have to be very, very holy in order to be a priest, and therefore there are very few people who qualify. And in addition to that, he has the priests elect the bishop by secret ballot so that there is no factional infighting. There's total freedom of religion. You can believe whatever you want to. There's a sort of one general thing, which is another sly joke. They only have one name. They usually go without a name for God. He didn't allow any images of God. How much more Protestant can you get than that? No images of God were allowed in the churches because you didn't want people to fight over it. And in addition to that, you wanted everyone to imagine for themselves what God was like. And so if you didn't have any image, they could all do it themselves. But he said there's only one name that they use for God, and that's Mithra. Mithra. Now, Mithra is a very unusual name to be chosen as the name for God in Utopia, but it obviously means something. There was an ancient Roman god named Mithra, which was taken from the ancient Persian god named Mithra, although he was very much changed by the Romans. But there's also the joke that the word is myth. You know, Mithra, it's a myth. God is a myth. So, you know, those 3, 4, 5 layer jokes are throughout this book. You know, it's the kind of thing that all the you know, Latin scholars, you know, found so entertaining was, you know, all these, you know, multi-level jokes. So it's another element that he talked about. So he's in prison, and he's not cooperating with the king, and he knows he's you know, in serious trouble, but he also knows his family is in serious trouble. And people have often said, why didn't he just give his arguments? You know, he never said why he wouldn't do it. He never said, he just said, it's my conscience, I'm not gonna do this. And he never gave his reason for why he wouldn't sign. And he said he would sign certain things. He said he would sign the statement that made Henry the head of the church in England, because that's just an ecclesiastical function, and it's always done in different ways, and that didn't bother him at all. He would sign that one. But he wasn't gonna sign the one that said that he has charge of the doctrine, which was another one. Because that, and interestingly, people often think, and of course the Catholics hope, it reminds me, right at the end of Utopia, the last line is, you know, where he takes it all back. He says, well, I don't believe anything that guy just told me. You know, the guy that told him everything was a guy named Raphael Hithloday. Raphael is the name of an archangel. Hithloday means nonsense. So what he was saying was, it's just a bunch of archangelic nonsense that this guy was telling me. So he takes it all back at the end. I couldn't believe it, but I was being polite, and I figured, you know, since there was a law in Utopia that if you disputed too much about religious things, you'd get exiled, so I figured he didn't want to hear any contrary arguments, so I didn't. And then he says, about Europe, it would be nice if some of these ideas, you know, would influence our European culture. He said, but that's something more to pray for than hope for. you know, which makes it, you know, a very fine medieval distinction. You know, if you're rational, you would never hope for it. You might pray for it and hope that God comes in with, you know, some kind of really big thing and changes everybody. But if we're going to be rational about this, it'll just never happen. Just never happen. So I go back to Moore in prison. So he's in prison, and his family is not allowed to see him. He's not allowed to see him for 2 or 3 months. Unusual. And he's told during that time by one of the king's men that his family has all been executed because he's in prison. So he's sitting there thinking his whole family has been executed because he's in prison. And after they let him sit on that for a month, they tell him it's not true, that they haven't executed his family, and he better cooperate or they will. And he doesn't give in then either. But then he's very upset and convinced not to say anything, that the least stir he's going to make is what he's going to do, because he doesn't want his family. And he told his family, when he finally got back to being able to talk to him, he said, get out of the country as soon as I'm dead, you know, because it will only take him a couple of months or whatever to come after you, because they'll still be mad at me. So that is a big motive for a family man, obviously. And so that's another element of what was going on as he was in prison leading up to his death. But he wrote some very interesting and entertaining stories while he was in prison. And I'll tell you a little story, too. About 15 years ago, I was in London for a business deal. And I was in a meeting in the morning, and somebody, you know, had, you know, the local paper before it started, and it was sitting there. And there was a little thing saying, you know, Thomas More's room at the Tower of London is now open, you know, for visiting, and hadn't been open for a long time. And I'd been there before, and you never could get in. It's now open. And I thought, whoa, great. I haven't, you know, I really wanted to go see it. So I skipped the meeting in the afternoon and lunch, and I went over to the Tower of London, that line, and I got into the tour, and I went into the thing. And, you know, those of you who've been there, you know, they have these beefeaters that show you around in the old guard outfits and everything. And he's walking along, and of course, I'd studied Thomas More quite a bit already. And so I asked a couple of questions and so on and so forth. And he was very polite, gave me the answers. We get up into the room, and I looked around, and there was a window. There was a window that was not right. You know, it didn't look the way I had thought of it. And so I said, was that window changed after he was here? Because I thought it was an arrow slit window, not a window with panes and so on, but just something that you would, a slit in the wall where you would throw arrows out of. And he said, yes, it used to be an arrow slit window. And now, are you going to give the tour or am I going to give the tour? So for those of you who know me, you probably don't believe it, but I actually shut up after that. So he's in this not a bad room. The room is about as big as this room, I would say, that he was in. That was his prison room. It was, you know, stark walls and so on and so forth, but it wasn't a tiny room, and he had a desk to work at. And when they were mad at him, they would take away his books and everything like that, and then he would get a piece of charcoal, and he'd write on, you know, paper that was smuggled in, and he'd write letters to his daughter on that. And then when they were nice to him and trying to, you know, the carrot and stick approach, they'd give him back his books and his papers, and then he would work. So they did this for a long time, and it was pretty clear at the end that he was going to die. And King Henry was very nice to him. He didn't have him drawn and quartered as he was, you know, supposed to be drawn and quartered. For those of you who know what drawn and quartered is, you know, it's a very unpleasant way to go. You know, your limbs are tied to four different horses, and they're all sent in different directions. Instead, it was, you know, commuted to just beheading. So he was delighted about that, and made several jokes about it. When he was leaving to go get beheaded, just to show you, you know, how he was still a wit at the end, the lieutenant who had, you know, been in charge of him in the prison for a long time came to get him to go and get beheaded, and Moore was dressed in his best clothes. And the tradition was that the person who executed you got to get your clothes, you know, because you didn't need them anymore. And so the guy said to him, well, why'd you wear your best clothes, you know? And he said, because he's doing me such a nice favor, you know, and I want him to do a good job. And the guy said, no, you cannot do that. You cannot go in your best clothes, you know. The guy's a worthless fellow. You don't really, you know, you can't give him your best clothes. So he put it on his other garb, and got to the scaffolding. The scaffolding was very badly built. It was very, very weak, you know, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like for hanging. So it had to be more sturdy. It was just a little platform on which, you know, he put his head down and they chopped it off. So as the scaffolding was so weak, he stepped on it and it started creaking and everything. So he turned to the guy who had jailed him. He was in bad health at this point. The prison had ruined his health over the 2 years he was there. He said, "Could you please help me up the stairs? As for coming down, I'll take care of that myself." And then he got up, and this is what he said to the executioner. He said, when he was all ready and he was, you know, putting his head down on the block, he said, "Pluck up thy spirits, man," because the executioner was unhappy about killing him. "Pluck up thy spirits, man, and be not afraid to do thine office. My neck is very short. Take heed, therefore, thou strike not awry for saving thine honor." In other words, give it a nice quick blow and show off how good you can do this, because that's what I want. I don't want you to heck away at me for a while. So, you know, a guy that can pull that off when he's about to get killed is you know, this kind of wit, this kind of something about life that drives him. The ability to create a family life, for example. I mean, he had a very interesting family. In addition to his own children, he had the stepdaughter from his second wife and the maids. And they educated all the maids as well as the children together when they were teaching them. I mean, the girls didn't even get educated at all, but everybody was in the family got this education. He had a little zoo of animals that they did. And you'll see this in Utopia. One of the things that he mentions is that there is a strange sect of religion that actually believes that animals have souls too, but no one really gives them any hard time about it because it really is a genial heresy. You know, it's not something to really get excited about. Something totally against, you know, what you would think at the time, at medieval times. That's really, really, to make a distinction between humans and animals has always been very important, but especially important then. So Utopia itself is another joke, the name. Utopia in Latin means no place. U means no, so it's no place. Utopia in Greek, same sound, is EU, which means good place. And so the joke is a good place is no place. There is no good place. There is no place that's good. And you know, all of his friends would get the joke right away. It's kind of hard after all this time, if you're not both a Latin and Greek scholar, to see the joke, but it's like a perfectly obvious joke. Those of you who know there's a novel, Erewhon, it's just nowhere turned around backwards. I mean, that's what that word is. Same kind of joke, playing the same joke. In creating his religion for the Utopians, as I said, very Protestant. He not only let women be priests, he made a joke after the women were priests. He said they were mostly aged widows that were priestesses, you know, but they didn't have anything against women being priests as long as they were holy enough. And that they all voted, as I said, on who got to be in charge, that nobody set doctrine because they had complete freedom of religion. The theory was, I mean, or the history that he gave to Utopia was that there was a king called Eutopus that came and took over the island hundreds and hundreds of years earlier. And he noticed that people just fight over what they, you know, believe and fight over, and he wanted to have a little more harmony. And so he outruled all fighting about it, and he even outlawed disputing religious doctrine. You could discuss it reasonably, but if it got into a dispute, you could be enslaved, you know, in the society. Another element that I mentioned in the lead up to these things that is the kind of humor that the medievalist group of around Erasmus liked, was that gold and silver was of no use whatsoever to this society. First, it was a communist society, another idea plucked from Plato. And Moore at the end says, communism stuff, that'll never work. But the idea is that there would be no greed at all, and therefore people would be able to live together. And they had common stores of food, and they built it up. So they had no use for gold at all. They only used gold for a couple of things. They used gold supplies to bribe enemies that wanted to fight against them. So they would go in and try to bribe people to either kill their leader who was trying to make them go to war, because they said, you know, the people of that nation are not against us. It's just their leaders that are causing this problem. So we offer such and such if you go and kill your leader, and then you won't have to come to war against us. So they use that. And he said other people find this really awful, but we think the people who are responsible for the outrage are the ones who should pay the price for it. So he just totally went against what was thought at the time. But the way that the utopians made sure that gold and silver was available in their society to use for this purpose, but was of totally, you know, no interest to anybody, was very interesting. One, they made all of their chamber pots out of gold and silver, so that it had a very bad reputation. They made gold necklaces and gold earrings and gold rings, and gold crowns, but only the slaves wore them, so that it was a sign of slavery. And he tells this really funny story about how all the rich diplomats from another country came to Utopia not knowing their traditions, with all their finery at it. And as they made a parade up to the leader of Utopia, all the common people were going, "Oh, I feel so bad. Why did they send their slaves? why did they send their slaves to represent them? My goodness, you know what I mean?" And the other thing was diamonds. Diamonds were toys for children to play with, you know, as shiny baubles. So you were supposed to set it aside as part of becoming a mature adult. You set aside the shiny baubles of childhood. And so having diamonds was just considered childish. So the whole society thought of it that way. So it has a lot of little jokes like that, because, of course, all throughout Europe, it was exactly the opposite. And that was the way to say, you know, you actually, if you sent the incentives up this way, you could actually put an end to this problem. But, you know, he was also very skeptical and knew that pride would eventually get in the way of that too. I'm going to go to Q&A very soon, but I wanted to say a couple more things about some of the ideals, the real ideals that were in it. One of his ideals was that there were no lawyers. The reason there were no lawyers? He's a lawyer, right? And the reason there were no lawyers is because the laws were very simple and straightforward. Everybody could understand them, and they were very few. And he said, you know, it's an ancient philosophical idea. If you have very few laws and they're very simple, people will respect the laws and follow them. Well, at least not everyone, but more of them, because they don't think that the laws are out, you know, to nail them. They had education for everybody. They had this six-hour-a-day work week. They had as a total freedom of religion. The women and the men were almost exactly equal. There's a couple of small things, but very few differences between the men and the women. In general, it was a very, very unmedieval society. Now, another thing to know about the whole time of the writing and everything is it was written in 1516. Well, that's not that long after 1492, when Columbus discovered America. So there was a lot of stories about discoveries and new worlds and everything going around at the time. So another one of the jokes that Thomas More pulled off was that this was a real thing. That this, you know, he made all these sly comments so that his friends could see through it. But he was assuming all kinds of people would just assume that this was a real thing. And actually, there was a famous bishop in England at the time who signed up to go to become the bishop in Utopia because he thought it would be much, much better to be a bishop there than to be in England where the people didn't listen to him. So you know, people were pulled into this net, you know, of the satire, the sophisticated lie. But in addition to that, at the beginning, a lot of people have written, you know, the reason it was so convincing was because he described in detail the diameter, the boundaries of the land, and what it looked like and everything in detail. Now, I've searched, and I'm sure it must be somewhere, but I couldn't find it anywhere. The dimensions are totally irrational. You know, they cannot exist the way he described it. So it was giving details to make it sound like it real, but making it perfectly clear it wasn't. For example, the island of Utopia is supposed to be 200 miles wide at its thickest. And then it tapered off at both ends, and it came into like a new moon sort of situation. So if you imagine like a crescent moon, but all the way around to the edge. And there was only 11 miles in the opening there, and that led into the harbor, and that's why their harbor was well protected. And so he gave some reasons about it being protected. Now, if it starts at 200 wide and it's sort of this crescent moon shaped, what would the circumference be? Just who knows enough math for that? The circumference, if the if the crescent moon is 200 miles, the radius has to be at least 300 or 400 miles at the most, at the least. And it's 2 pi r, you know, for the radius. So it would have to be at least 1,000 or more miles to go around the radius, or go around the circumference. But he gave the circumference as 500 miles, you know, which is very clearly inaccurate, because it can't, even if 200 was the whole diameter of the circle, it still would be more than 500 miles. So he was testing people's math. Most people seem to have missed it. And in addition to that, he then says there are 54 cities, and they're at least 24 miles apart. And then he says, and everybody has, and then a page later, every city has at least, so that everybody can walk from one city to the other in one day. Yes, 24 miles. And then he said at another place, a page later, that the land around the cities is used for the farming, and they have at least 20 miles in all directions that's their land, which means that the distance between two cities has to be at least 40 miles. You know, and then if you try to put 54 cities that are that far apart on the thing, you can't get anywhere near 54 cities. So the whole thing is filled with information saying it doesn't exist. But I, as I said, if somebody looks it up and sees that somebody has written an essay on that, that this was not to be convincing by being realistic, but it was a joke, another joke, because that's what I think it was. So that's a little bit of an insight into the way Thomas More was looking at this and why he wrote it, and what happened to a man who was in his mid-30s, could do this, and decided to go for trying to help by being part of the king's entourage and realizing as he was moving along that he was really walking the plank, you know, towards the end of his life. And how can he do that the best for his family, the best for everybody else? And then he walked off the plank making jokes. That's the Thomas More that I know. So. So I suppose I have to do the reminder that you're listening to George Hammond speaking at the Commonwealth Club on Thomas More's Utopia, the 500th anniversary. It's time for Q&A. Anybody have any questions? Okay, wait for the microphone so that we can get it recorded. There's.
Why was Utopia so popular at that time? And why has it endured since that time? Why was it popular?
Yeah.
At the time. It was actually very popular at the time.
And then why was it ignored?
And why has it endured?
I would say it was very popular at the time. It took a while, first of all. It was really a private thing until for 20, 30 years among the people in the know on the continent. It didn't get its first English translation until 1557, something like that. So almost 40 years after it was written and after Thomas More and his family passed. One of the things that's valuable about the whole family story is that the educated daughters made sure that their father became famous by promoting his work and making sure that it got done in English and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and collecting all of his works. So, you know, there's a lot of stories like with Nietzsche, he had a sister who did that and so on. But that's one story. I mean, Moore was extremely well known there on the continent. And when he got killed, there's a story that the Emperor of Austria, you know, one of King Henry's rivals, wrote a letter and said, you know, I would have rather given up a city than given up Moore. I don't know how you killed him. I mean, what were you thinking, you know? And why it's not ignored, I think, is very simple, because it goes into explaining all kinds of ways we could do things better. And maybe they're not all taken at face value. Some of them are jokes, some of them are, but it's a real, we could make our civilization much, much better than we do. Why don't we? Why don't we? Why do we listen to, I mean, just those jokes about the gold and silver is a total dismissal of aristocracy. You know, he's very clearly a Democrat he's a voice. In addition, he's a voice for individual conscience versus everything else. I mean, he was willing to die for his conscience, even though he knew it wouldn't change anything. I want to say one more thing about that, because there's another element to what was going on in Moore's mind at the time. And what was going on was, just like in Utopia, about religious wars and people, you know, he wrote about that. He knew about that his whole life, and he then knew from Luther. Why was he so mad at Luther? He was so mad at Luther because he and Erasmus had started this attempt to reform the Catholic Church in a very reasonable way and to talk about it. In a reasonable way, and then Luther ran off with it in a wild way that was going to cause violent disruptions rather than a rational argument. And if you think that you got it started and someone runs away with it, you know, like, you know, it never happens in politics. Somebody comes along and grabs the conservative mantle and makes a mess out of it. And everybody is going, how did that happen? You know, but he makes a louder, more persuasive and more popular version of what they were doing. And by ruining it, he ruined their project. And they had to go back and suddenly stand up for the Pope in spite of the fact that they knew he was corrupt and everything, because they were trying to hold on to whatever order you could have in Europe. And absolutely correctly, he foresaw that there would be wars, religious wars, for a long period of time after everything split up. Because the only thing that was keeping the lid on, it was like if you were in Yugoslavia and you said, I don't like Tito. Tito is really lousy, but if we get rid of Tito or not somebody like Tito, everybody's going to kill each other. And that's exactly, I think, how Moore saw Europe at the time. And he didn't want to have anything to do with anything that helped move that forward. And the history right after he died is exactly along that line. It's just the same thing. And I think that's another thing. When you're in public service, you have to make a decision. Where, at what point do you say, I can't do any more good. I have to step out and say, I can't be part of this. You know, and very few public servants ever do that, but some do. So did I answer everything now? Okay, great. Anyway, whichever one you want, Bill.
I have a two-parter. First of all, if Utopia was so great, why did they have slavery?
Yeah.
And second of all, if he was a saint, what miracle did he perform?
All right, I'll do the slavery first. You know, I there was no natural slavery, but there was, if you were a criminal, there was slavery, and you had to work. And he felt that the hard work would give them the idea that they could accomplish something. And there were several ways to get out of slavery if you actually were good at the work that you do. You could make your way back into normal society again. So it was a very mild form of prison, is what it really was. And although it is slavery, I mean, nobody thought that there was no slavery at the time, because there was slavery in lots of places. But he used it about as mildly as he could. I would change several things. I'm not in agreement with everything. But it was a very interestingly mild form of prison. For anybody that, and most things were not imprisonable. Moore writes a lot about in Utopia as well. He says, you know, that it's the laws that make people thieves. You know, he cuts down on England's, you know, so he has somebody praise England in Utopia for having such strict laws that, you know, kill so many thieves, hang them, you know, and that will really show them, and so on and so forth. And he says it's not the law, it's the poverty that makes people do that. And no matter how strict you make it, people are going to steal if they're starving. And so you have to either arrange society so the people are not starving before you do something about thievery. And besides, thievery is not that big an offense, which is another very interesting statement for the time. And about the sainthood, yeah, it's very interesting. As I said, it took him 400 years to call him a saint, because, you know, he has a lot of things in his writing which they will never quote. Anyway, I can't go into great detail, but just on one issue after another, his ideas are much more universal. He really was, in my opinion, as I said, he had this three-way problem, all good things. He wanted human civilization to be better, which is very obvious from his writing. He wanted reason to be in charge, you know, something reasonable and orderly that you could explain to people, being a Platonic philosopher. And he believed in God. And as he said, you know, I die the king's good servant, but God's first. That's what he said when he was dying, too. And it's interesting that in his writing, you can kind of tell that the God part was the thinnest of the three, of those three things. But that's why he was quite willing to dispense with all kinds of things that were considered indispensable by religion. Because God was a stand-in for the aim for perfection, the aim for something better, and so on and so forth in life. And that was, of course, a Greek ideal too, the Platonic ideal of and the Greek ideal of the perfectibility of man. Personally, I think that this is the idea that's gotten in the way of most of these characters. Because if you believe in that, you believe that there is some divine will which you are following to try to move people in that direction. And so you're serving that divine will in an attempt to create perfection. And if you don't feel that there's a divine will saying that, that it's more of a democracy, that life is a democracy, we're all making it up as we go along, then you don't put so much pressure on other people. And his natural inclination was to not put pressure on other people. He did not punish his children. You know, he didn't ever physically punish him, which is outrageous at that time. But in addition, they didn't even punish him at all. He just talked them out of whatever problem they had and made them laugh and giggle, and they would run off. And sometimes they would pretend to have done something wrong to go get punished because it was so much fun. It was the one way to get your dad's attention, I guess. Oh, so I have to answer the last part. So why was he a saint? I don't know what miracles they came up with. I mean, there are always some miracles, you know. But, you know, my point is, I think, you know, it took him 400 years, and I think at that point it was already too late.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask, kind of to extend that no place and good place mm-hmm. kind of binary further. Is it, you know, in the scholarship historically on this work, has it been kind of perceived as being prescriptive in some sense, that it sets out this model to be followed, or alternatively make fun of it, you know, kind of that such a play could ever exist? Mm-hmm. Or thirdly, that, you know, it kind of sets it up as something impossible to aspire to, or somehow does it walk that plank between mockery and kind of prescriptive?
Mm. I'm going to quote Goethe on this one, just a little bit to the side. He said, the most useful thing in the world would be someone who could tell us when these guys who wrote those, like Plato, and when they were joking or when they were serious, you know, and when they were, you know, when they were half joking and half serious, and which half was joking and which half was serious. Because this is a part of all those writings, you know, in Plato all the way down. There's so many jokes and you can't quite tell. It's sly humor. It's not, you don't point at it right away. I mean, all that detail about the island, you know, why would he be giving a mathematical, you know, geometrical test to everybody? But he was, because he figured nobody would pay attention, because, you know, they'd study the scriptures and could see that there was plenty of things that were in the scriptures that everyone had been ignoring for 1,500 years by that point, you know. And so I think the important thing is that it's both. It's everything all at the same time. It's both prescriptive and it's not going to happen, you know. It's both a good place and it's not going to happen unless we get around in some way or another to shifting our way of thinking as human beings. But if we're not going to shift our way of thinking as human beings, then it's important to understand, when everyone's complaining all the time, why it is that things are the way they are. Instead of saying, you know, we just can't help ourselves, this is the way we are. No, you can say, it's because of this idea and this idea and this that you want, and you put importance on this instead of this, that you cause this. And that goes right back to Socrates, who said, you know, people are not evil in themselves. People make mistakes because they can't see what's bigger and what's smaller, because they don't have perspective, because the good thing is further away and the other thing is closer, and so it looks bigger, and so they don't have enough perspective to see what's good and what's bad for themselves, for their own self-interest. Now, that idea has been submerged totally because, you know, in our society, because Christianity thinks self-interest is a problem. I don't think Jesus thought that way, but I think the basic idea in Christianity is self-interest is something you have to overcome in order to do God's will. Whereas, you know, in Moore, it's just the opposite. He thinks that, you know, all the good things in life are things that are virtuous. All the things that bring pleasure in life are virtuous and couldn't make it. He has a great, I have a little time, just to show you. He also says how insane the utopians think that the pursuit of pain and suffering in order to get someplace later on is totally insane. And he quotes them he says, to punish oneself for the empty shadow of virtue to no one's advantage, or to strive after greater fortitude for an adversity that may never come, all this they think is absolutely insane. And it goes on for a couple of pages, which don't have time for, earlier on in the book, explaining the whole principle of pleasure, and explaining just a great thing. There's two, sorry about the questions, but there's just two things from here I really want to say. He has this great argument, you know, just philosophical, Platonic type arguments, about people thinking that gold is so important. He says, okay, so now, you have gold and you have a problem. You think that it makes you look better than everybody else in society. Well, that's one problem. That just seems ridiculous. But on the other hand, there's people who hide their gold and then they feel good. They hide it underground and then they feel comfortable that they are now safe by hiding their gold. He said, and you know, they have it hidden for 10 years. They never checked it. They don't know whether it's still there or not. They don't know whether someone stole it a long time ago, but they still feel good about it because they think it's under the ground. He said, so what good does that do you? I mean, that's a total double illusion. And he has in the pleasure thing, he says, even the most outrageous religion, you know, would never say that you shouldn't try to help other people live better lives, happier lives, have more joy in their lives, right? Even when you're supposed to be miserable yourself in doing it, you're supposed to help other people. He said, that doesn't make any sense at all. Because if people are not supposed to be happy in this life, then you should be taking their joy away from them. You should be making them as miserable as possible so they can go to heaven. You know? And so you're doing exactly the opposite of what you should do. And either it is that you should bring joy to them, you should even bring more joy to yourself so that you can bring more joy to them, or you should, you know, go out there and really believe this and make other people miserable. But you can't have it both ways. It doesn't make any sense at all. That's, again, an argument in the middle of the medieval times, which is just totally, you know, it's very convincing when you hear it, but it's totally ignored anyway. So I think it's things like that that make it last. You know, ideas that make people keep looking at it and saying, wow, it sounds modern. It's 500 years ago. It sounds modern observations. So some of the things, you know, some of the things could be quoted right by the 99% against the 1%, you know, without changing at all any of the words. Charlie or Jojo, we have time for a little bit more. Whoever.
Thank you, George. It's always so exciting to hear you speak. And of course, I know a lot of people who like to have another person be miserable because they themselves are miserable. So that makes
right.
Another. I loved it when he spoke of dawn lectures because yeah. I was wondering, couldn't that be his own private time to have a little lecture with himself and with God?
Oh, well, he certainly did that.
And that's something. And the other thing, I got a kick out of the gold for the slaves because yeah. with all due respect to the gentleman in the audience, when a man gives a woman a lot of gold, it's one way to possess her and she becomes his slave. So there you are.
But the slave has to cooperate.
Well, you know, a lot of people do a lot for gold.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Charlie?
In Wolf Hall, a different light is cast on Thomas More.
Absolutely.
For one thing, accusing him of torturing
right.
dissident Protestants. What do you think about that?
Oh, it's a lie. There's a lot of evidence about this. You know, one of the things that I said was how Protestant utopia is. And I think if the Protestants want to get over their hatred of Thomas More, they should just read his book and say, you know, he was really in favor of this until it went off the rails as far as he was concerned and was going to cause social disruption throughout Europe, which I think he predicted accurately. Certainly when he was the top judge, there were two or three people that were killed as a result of their heresies. But it would be like saying that Obama is responsible for capital punishment or something like that now. And there's one story that he took, you know, somebody who was a heretic and whipped him in his private home or something like that. Totally a bogus story that has no basis in fact. More's son-in-law, you know, became a heretic right when he was Lord Chancellor and coming down on people. And he had long discussions with them all the time. And it was before he married his daughter, actually, and said, you know, just keep thinking about it. Just keep thinking about it. And if you find that your way back to the church, you can marry my daughter. You know, and if you don't, you know, you can't. That's all he did. And as soon as when he came back, he let his daughter marry him. That's the guy who wrote the biography of him, Roper. So, you know, it's very easy when someone, you know, I mean, he was totally vilified. At the time, because of course he was against the king's thing. And why do people vilify somebody? You know, if he's a good example, as Mark Twain said, there is nothing harder to put up with than a good example. And you know, there's all these priests and bishops all doing what the king said, and then there's this guy who was the Lord Chancellor who doesn't go along. Now, there was another bishop who was a friend of his who didn't go along, but, you know, only a handful of people didn't go along, and they all lost their heads. And all the people who went along felt miserable for going along, right? And when you feel miserable, what do? You turn to the other people and try to make them more miserable. And so you imagine all the bad things that somebody did. Now, I'm not saying that he was a saint in the classic sense, you know, he did everything right all the time. But he wasn't a torturer, and he was not, you know, you read his book, it's very clear. Now, they can look at the evidence of all the books. He wrote really long diatribes against Luther and some of the other ones, where he was very mad, very angry. That's a whole other topic. But that was in his books. He was known to never be mad in daily life, never lose his temper. He lost his temper because of Luther, because Luther stole his project, walked away with it, and ruined it, so that he now had to do something he didn't want to do and ruin his family because of it. It's enough to make somebody mad, at least in the middle of the night when he wrote the books. He stayed up all night writing those books. That didn't help his health either. All right, one last question.
In his death, was he influenced by Boethius?
Influenced by Boethius?
Yes.
Yes. He'd read Boethius. And he wrote a book called The Four Last Things, as I said, in 1922. But he also wrote a book, Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation, which he wrote while he was in prison, which is he has a lot of lighthearted, funny stories in it. He has a lot of things, but it's again, what's important in life versus what's not important. And even though family was like the second most important thing, this other thing is a little bit more important. And in addition to that, he felt that giving that example to his family, that they would be able to also, you know, do the more important thing in life if they ever got shoved into a box by somebody too. You know, it's no different really than the advice that Dumbledore gives to Harry Potter, right? He says, you know, Voldemort's mistake is that he thinks there's nothing worse than death. But that's just totally untrue. There are plenty of things that are worse than death. And losing your principles, losing your thing, even if your principles are inaccurate, to be quite honest, it's still better to stick to your principles and then reasonably adjust them later, if you still have a later, than it is to just always do whatever it can be so that you don't die. And this is true even in daily life. You know, when our society is so afraid of death, you know, that we live and live and live in states that we really don't want to. But why? Because we really don't accept it. And we've talked about that before here. There's a very simple thing about death, you know. There's only two chances. There's two options, right? Either you're still alive or you're not still alive, right? And if you're not still alive, you can't be unhappy. You know, you can't be afraid. You can't experience anything. And so to be afraid of something is to anticipate that you're going to be unhappy. So that anticipation you're going to be unhappy after your death, if you think that your death is the end, is just impossible. It's an impossible thing. It's our imagination being inaccurate. And the other thing is, if you still live, then you probably are still pretty much what you were beforehand. And therefore, if you like yourself, it's all right. But if you don't like yourself, then you have to worry about overcoming the fear of continuing rather than the fear of death. So you know, it's good to work on the fear, the enjoyment of your life now, so that you don't have that fear of continuing, but there's no reason to be afraid of death whatsoever. And to go back to, I think I'll finish with the last part of your question, Charlie, about Wolf Hall. I find it very interesting that we are so in the midst of a society that likes conniving bastards, that we get rid of the principled people and say they're the bad guys. And isn't it clever how this guy outsmarted everybody and got where he was until he lost his head? You know, because it's a very interesting phenomenon, I think. Maybe we don't think that there is any such thing as a hero anymore, but I don't know. I mean, looking for Cromwell as a way to feel better about that time seems really misguided. Anyway, that's all I have to say about Cromwell. If you want me to talk about Richard Rich, I'll even get worse. So thank you very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion.